Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I've brought Todd Howell with me, who is the administrator of the Graceville Healthcare Facility. I don't know if you call it a merger, but they worked with the Clinton facility, and the Clinton facility closed, and they had a bit of a glitch in some of the transfers that were supposed to take place, and so Senate File 377 is an attempt to deal with that closure rate adjustment, but I'll let Mr. Howell tell the committee about it.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today supporting Senate Filing 377. My name is Todd Howell, and I'm the administrator at Graceville Health Center, located in Graceville, Minnesota. We have 50 Medicare and Medicaid certified skilled nursing facility beds, a 15-bed critical access hospital, and two rural health clinics. I'm here today to ask for the planned closure rate adjustment for an 8-bed facility previously located in the city of Clinton, Minnesota, that was to have reassignment to Grace Home in Graceville, Minnesota. Initially, the Clinton Providence Center was owned by Graceville Health Center. In 2004, Graceville Health Center decided to close the Clinton Providence Center. With opposition to the closing from the City of Clinton, Graceville Health Center agreed to sell the facility, including 8 skilled nursing facility beds, to the City of Clinton for their use as an 8-bed nursing home assisted living facility. In the purchase agreement, the City of Clinton agreed that if they ever needed to close the remaining beds, they would follow the proper process to transfer the closure rate adjustment to Graceville Health Center. In 2005, the City of Clinton decided to close the remaining 8 beds and to become only an assisted living facility. As stated in the purchase agreement, City of Clinton staff filled out the appropriate paperwork for the planned closure rate adjustment and sent the appropriate page to Graceville Health Center to sign. The paperwork was signed in June 2005 and returned to Clinton for completion and submission prior to the final bed closure. After sending the paperwork back to the City of Clinton, Graceville Health Center staff understood that Clinton staff would file the paperwork pursuant to the contract. The skilled nursing facility beds were closed in Clinton on August 4th, 2005. However, Clinton staff did not submit the paperwork to the Department of Human Services until after the bed closure on September the 3rd, 2005. Because the Clinton facility did not file the paperwork in a timely fashion, the planned closure rate adjustment was denied. It is Graceville Health Center's position that we acted in good faith and did everything possible to make sure the rate increase was received. Senate Filing 377 provides a legislative remedy for this situation and allows for Graceville Health Center to be in a position similar to that had the original paperwork been submitted to the Department of Human Services. Members, I ask for your support of this legislation and would be pleased to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Senator Kubley, we like the way your fiscal note looks. We might add you to the committee because we need more fiscal notes like this one.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to take credit for it, but I don't do fiscal notes.
any questions? If not, we'll lay this over then. Does Senator Lynch want to make the motion for Senator Kubley?
So moved.
Senator Lynch moves that Senate File 377 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any discussion? Members. Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Senator Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and member of the committee. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to present 281, which is a financial stability package for nursing facilities across the state of Minnesota. This proposal is supported by the Long-Term Care Imperative, a collaboration of care providers of Minnesota and the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance, and it is a bipartisan effort to take the first steps toward addressing the significant needs our state will face in caring for our older Minnesotans. We have all heard about the impending age wave, and we know we need to prepare to care for a large senior population larger than we ever had in the past. But before we can talk about new ways to care for seniors, we must take care of our existing care centers. Over the past 4 years, we have asked care centers to participate in the solution to the budget deficit by either freezing reimbursement rates or providing an increase that was less than the rate of inflation. In the past 4 years, rate increases for care centers have totaled just 4.6%, while inflation over that same period was 11.6%. This funding situation has hit care centers hard, especially because, unlike other sectors of the budget, care centers have no way to make up for the funding cuts through increased fees or taxes. Rather, they have to make choices that directly impact the residents they serve. Maintenance to buildings has been deferred. Facilities have had to spend down reserves just to keep their doors open, and benefits to employees have been cut. Senate File 281 asked the legislature to rectify our past budget decisions by providing a rate increase of 7% in the first year of the biennium and an additional 6% for the second year of the biennium. The 7 and 6% rate increases are based on real need and are a sort of catch-up that takes into account actual inflation and actual rate shortfalls of the past 4 years. This will help stabilize the financial picture for care centers so that we can begin to move out of addressing the need for older adult services in a crisis mode and begin to discuss what we will need to meet the age wave of the future. This proposal also addresses the rate shortfalls facilities experience throughout the state. Currently, facilities on average lose nearly $20 a day per resident. This gap between Minnesota's reimbursement rate and actual costs of care make Minnesota one of the worst in the nation in MA reimbursement gaps. Some of the local bills before you today are symptomatic of this problem. Some believe that the state can afford to fix the reimbursement gap for the entire state, so we should at least increase the rates for those in the worst shape. But I believe this is a statewide problem that demands a statewide solution. Senate File 281 proposes that we address this issue on a statewide basis by rebasing rates in 2008. Later, I will present an amendment that provides a proposal to phase in rebasing over a three-year period. This proposal will align operating rates with the actual cost of providing care to residents. The state has not rebased rates on the cost of care since 1994. Rebasing rates helps address the issue of differing rates for each facility because the rebase rates will actually be based on the cost of care in each facility. And right now, there are discrepancies around the state and within the districts. For one facility in my district, Bayshore, this rebasing proposal would allow it to increase its average operating rate of $109.29 to $134.49, a 23% increase. It currently is $17 a day under the next lowest rate for nursing facilities in that district. Rebased operating rates will be phased in over 3 years, starting with the October 1st, 2008 year. Operating rates will continue to be rebased every other year starting October 1st, 2011, and in years without rebasing, facilities will receive an inflation increase to their rates. Ongoing rebasing means that the gap between MA rates and costs of care should not develop again. I acknowledge that this proposal will require a significant investment of state resources. However, it is the right policy to ensure equality care for our seniors, and equality among the nursing homes. Rebasing of rates is estimated to cost about $25.6 million in the second year of the coming biennium. There are many other important parts of this bill that help ensure access to quality care to our seniors. It seeks to expand this successful negotiated rate category to include other forms of specialized care. It extends the rate enhancement for new admissions. It funds implementation of the new case mix indices to acknowledge the increased cost to care for residents with behavioral issues, and it continues the quality add-on incentive established in the last budget cycle. And with me today are Carrie Thurlow of the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance and Patty Cullen of Care Providers of Minnesota to go over the details of this provision, of these provisions, and answer any questions. But before we do that, Madam Chair, I have a few amendments here. And the first amendment is the A4 amendment. Okay. And I believe they need to be distributed, Madam Chair. This is the rebasing amendment, and Patty, are you? I'm going to ask Patty Cullen to explain it to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patty Cullen. I am here to talk about the A4 amendment that's being passed out, so I'll talk slowly while you're receiving a copy of the amendment. We engaged a national consultant in the fall of last year who has actually been doing the rebasing, who did the rebasing for seven other states, to kind of give us a handle on what's the best way to rebase our rates given this current system that we have and given the gap between the last time we had close to rebasing, which is when we had a cost-based system that didn't have spend-up caps. And as Senator Prettner-Solon said, that was about 1994. There's only a few ways that states can actually rebase rates, and we selected the proposal before you as a as probably the least expensive and the most direct mechanism. We also chose to do it in a phased-up manner because the fiscal note to just do it overnight was pretty significant. So the phase-in for 3 years is an adjustment that, although our consultant said it's probably not the best way to do it, we went back to the drawing table several weeks ago and came up with the phased-in approach. Essentially what this does is it requires a collection of data which already is being collected by the state. The state looks at these data, at the data submitted on a facility-specific basis, and divides the data into two cost categories, essentially, one relating to all the direct care needs and one relating to support services, because you want to make sure that you allow for higher costs in direct care, because that's, frankly, the important part of the services we do. And then it establishes caps on how much you can go up between your costs and between the rates you're receiving. When we've calculated out all of the data going out over 3 years with our consultant and asked him about the questions about whether or not it makes sense to divide out into different peer groups and to hospital attached and non-hospital attached, the answer was it does make sense in your state. So we do have a proposal that still does divide into groups within the state, and we also have the limits are applied to the care related for both hospital attached separately from the non-hospital attached facilities, again, because of the data that we collected showed that does make some sense in terms of what the end outcome is. The other thing I think it's important to note is that we put in this proposal a regular schedule for rebasing. As you know from looking at the budget forecast and the numbers for the hospital rebasing, it's pretty important for facilities for nursing facilities, Medicaid providers, to have rebasing built into their system. We had delayed rebasing because we had attempted for years to try to do new payment systems, and for a variety of reasons, that just didn't happen. One of the reasons why you have a lot of individual bills before this committee and a lot of concerns about the rate disparities is without rebasing, all you're doing is applying a COLA on a base, and those with a lower base will get a lower dollar value moving forward. And rebasing is one way to address that on a statewide basis to say, okay, in addition to between rebasing years getting an inflation adjustment, we're also suggesting that we relook at your costs compared to what your rates are and adjust that as well every other year. The first time you do it, because the gap between our Medicaid rates and our costs is very significant, the first time you do it will cost real money. And there's nothing we can do to stop that, even a phase-in approach, because it's been so long since we've done rebasing, and the Medicaid gap is about $19 a day. So that's what essentially the Cliff Notes version of what A4 does. Now, I can certainly respond to any specific questions built into that, but it's probably...
Are there any questions on the A4 amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Okay, and then, Madam Chair, I have the A1 amendment. And this is really a technical amendment. And then on the A1 amendment, do you have that in your? Okay, I believe that's been distributed. I'd like to delete everything after on line 1.3 after page 4. Delete everything except after page 4, add delete section 4.
Could you repeat that?
On the A1 amendment, delete everything after page 4 on line 1.3 and add the words delete section 4.
So essentially we're just adopting the first two lines of the amendment and deleting section 4 of the bill?
Yes.
Okay. Any discussion on that amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Okay. And then, Madam Chair, the next amendment is the A3 amendment. Do you have that amendment? And this is the...
We have an A2 also. Did you want...
We can do the A2 first if you wish. And the A2 amendment expands access to specific services in home and community-based settings to avoid hospitalization or nursing home placement. And I'll have Carrie Thurlow explain that amendment.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm with the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance. Very briefly, the provisions in this bill are provisions that were introduced by Senator Lynch earlier this session, and they deal with the elderly waiver program in making some changes that would expand access to specific services in home and community-based settings. I'll just briefly summarize the provisions of this amendment and then be happy to answer any questions. Starting on the first page of the amendment, it will allow increased access to incidental nursing services directly by a licensed nurse under either a Class A or a Class F home care license. This would allow for additional incidental nursing services that are currently not covered by the elderly waivered service waiver program, but may be required by residents in order to stay in a home setting. And I think there are some examples there that include injections, diabetic foot care, catheter insertion, monitoring, a blood test for therapeutic treatments, nursing assessments, and other services that may also be identified by the Commissioner of Human Services. It's important to note that this provision of the amendment does not expand the caps of the elderly waiver program, but would allow access to these services if they are allowable within the caps that currently exist. On the second page of the amendment, then, would allow rate exceptions for individuals for a temporary time period of 30 days or less for increased needs for a client to avoid either hospitalization or nursing home placement. And let me tell you what we're thinking here. We've had providers give us specific examples where they have clients that may need increased services for a temporary time period in order to allow them to stay in a home or community-based setting. For example, when a client is discharged from a hospital, they may need more intensive treatment for a short period of time, including increased monitoring and the like. We are proposing a temporary increase of the rate to allow more intensive services for that temporary time period. Also, if we have providers viewing a client that may becoming unstable, if they need a temporary increase in services to stabilize that client's condition, again, this provision would apply. But again, it's for a very short time period of 30 days or less. The final provision of the amendment is a study and a report with regard to the long-term care consultations. There's two particular aspects that we are proposing to study. The first would be the length of time it takes each county or joint county consultation team to complete a long-term care consultation as required under Minnesota law. We do have providers expressing concerns over the time it is taking to complete long-term care consultations, and to get a better handle on the issue, we are proposing a study to also propose recommendations on how to improve this process. The second part of the study then would propose methods and tools that the county agencies could use to establish the level of and payment rates of customized living and 24-hour customized living services. We're not necessarily proposing uniform rate setting throughout the state of Minnesota. We do believe in individualized and customized plans, but we are seeing wide variability in the process used to determine those rates. And we feel, again, that it is important to study that issue and make recommendations on that point. So those are the three provisions of this amendment. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Do you have any idea how much this will increase the cost of the elderly waiver program?
Madam Chair, I have not seen a fiscal note on this yet, and I don't have an estimate. I apologize.
Well, just for the members' information, the fiscal note that we have on this bill only is for the COLA portion of the bill. We have nothing on rebasing or any of the other portions of the bill. So maybe we'll, when you're done with your witnesses, Senator Solon, we'll get the department up here to ask them a few questions.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, I offer the A2 amendment then. Madam Chair, I move the A2 amendment.
Is there any discussion of the A2 amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
And then, Madam Chair, I have one more amendment, the A3 amendment. And this is an encumbrance amendment on the wages, and it's language that was agreed to with the seniors and the workers. And I'm not sure who wants to speak to that. Ms. Cullen will.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Patty Cullen. The language before you is something that initially was brought up at the nursing facility work group with the Department of Human Services. Over the course of the years, nursing facilities have had an encumbrance. A certain percentage of the COLA must be given to staff wages and benefits. And there was a detailed process established in statute and in more detail in bulletin. We've had some issues and concerns with how certain parts of this COLA encumbrance had been implemented, both from the union perspective as well as from the provider perspective. So we decided to all meet together and come up with some language that we felt would address those concerns. And one example is the way the statutory language had been written. It required us to, even if we fired an employee, to track them down and to give them a retroactive rate increase. And we felt that really wasn't likely the legislative intent when you say all employees need to get this amount. So we worked with this group in this amended language. As you can see, there's blanks in two portions of it, because that is the part that I believe the committee needs to come up with the percentage of the COLA. So we don't have a COLA percentage included in this now. What we have is we have blanks on the percentage of the encumbrance and a blank on the actual COLA amount, but all the other specific language is agreed to by the parties.
I guess I haven't seen this until today, so, but based on what I understand about it, I think the concern that I would have is that it still would allow facilities to dedicate their COLA to health care costs, and those health care benefits may not be applied equitably to all the employees in the facility. And that's the problem that we've been coming up with this year, where we've been getting calls from people saying that they didn't get the COLA that we voted on. And so I think that members might want to do something about that problem so that we don't have that problem happening again.
Madam Chair, in response to that concern, we did ask for some information on the compensation plans that we have submitted to take a look at that exact question, and for the nursing facilities, because we have had the ability to track this with our data. 95% is the number above and beyond what we get for a COLA that we spend on wages and benefits. So our comp plans reflect even greater amount given to the wages and benefits. So I think I would be surprised if we had nursing facilities given those dollars amount that gave it all to
insurance. This
law,
Ms. Cullen, does not just apply to nursing facilities. COLA applies to all long-term care providers. And we have had, certainly, I don't know how many of the problems have been actually with nursing homes, but we have had a number of problems with the COLA being passed on to long-term care workers in general. So was this agreement negotiated just with nursing homes?
It just applies to the nursing facility portion of the.
Okay. Any other discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Do you have any other testimony?
No, Madam Chair, that's it. Okay. And I'm seeing the fiscal note for the first time today, too, and I realize it doesn't include the amendments.
So maybe we could ask folks from the department to come up to the table for a few minutes. Welcome.
Thank you.
First, let me ask you, my understanding of this bill and this fiscal note is it only applies to nursing homes, not to any other long-term care provider group?
Madam Chair, I'm Bob Hild from the Department of Human Services. The fiscal note, yeah, this, you're correct. This applies only to the nursing home. The I think it was the A2 amendment, the one on elderly waiver, is not incorporated into this fiscal note.
And there is nothing in the fiscal note about rebasing?
Madam Chair, that's correct. We did not have the language in the amendment in order to compute that, nor have we seen the modeling that was done in developing that system.
So will we be getting a fiscal note on it?
Madam Chair, we do. Yeah, if a fiscal note is requested, we will do
well,
that.
When we have a hearing, we're kind of requesting a fiscal note, you know.
We will provide a fiscal note on that, yes.
Madam Chair, on the elderly waiver, you said that this includes the elderly waiver, and here it does not. It does not. And I believe the elderly waiver should show savings because it will be avoiding hospitalization or long-term care placement, too.
Well, of course, the hospitalization costs are Medicare.
Nursing home facilities, though.
We'll see.
I'm sure the rebasing amendment that was introduced and adopted earlier today does give us the language to be able to do a fiscal note on the rebasing.
Okay. And on the elderly waiver amendment, is that language adequate for you to do a fiscal note?
Madam Chair, I'm Sue Bankin from the Department of Human Services. We need to work with the stakeholders. There are some parts of the language that are unclear that make it difficult to do a fiscal note without some assumptions attached to those. We've talked with the stakeholders and are planning to work with them on what those assumptions would be. And we would be able to either agree that that would be part of the fiscal note or give you a fiscal advisory on what the cost would be of that section.
And Senator Prettner-Solon, was it your intention that we not give any COLA to the other long-term care providers, that we only provide one to the nursing homes?
No, Madam Chair, was not.
And so do you have an idea of how much the cost would be if we apply the same COLA to all the long-term care providers?
Well, I'm being advised an estimate is it's about $300 million if you do 7 and 6 for all continuing care workers.
Any questions?
And Madam Chair, just a plea that for years we have not rebased. We have not given cost of living raises to these workers.
Well, they had cost of living increases last time. There was a COLA given last time. 2¾ and 2¾.
But they have not had an effective way of keeping up with the costs of the facility since about 1992.
Well, I agree there has not been rebasing, and it's just it's a fiscally difficult situation to try to rebase when we're recovering from a deficit. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Prettner-Solon, I just wanted to weigh in for just a brief moment on the rebasing issue because I think that what this bill does is really supports some strong, good public policy. And I'm appreciative of Senator Prettner-Solon bringing the discussion forward, because part of what I hope that we do as a governing body is talk about what good public policy is and what's the right direction, what's the right thing to do. And I certainly understand the fiscal constraints that we all are operating under and faced with. But, again, to the notion of rebasing and the intent put forth by this legislation, I just want to commend Senator Prettner-Solon.
Okay. Any other discussion? Yes, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Prettner-Solon. And I would also just like to echo Senator Lynch's remarks. I think that while nursing homes around the state are struggling, some are struggling more than others, and the idea of avoiding rebasing is avoiding addressing that issue. I think in the long run, with the increasing demographic of the older population that we all know is coming, if we lose our nursing homes in the areas that are hurting the most, we're going to have to spend more in the long run as a state to recover from that problem. And so this is a serious issue. I think I would really encourage this committee to attempt to address.
Madam Chair. And
Senator Prettner-Solon.
I would like to just remind people, too, that because of the problems that we've gotten into without the rebasing, the disparities have become so large that there are 43% of the facilities in northeastern Minnesota and 41% in southwestern Minnesota that are in danger of closing because they cannot keep up with the rates that they're paid, and they're in dire financial straits.
Well, we have to get a fiscal note on the rebasing so we can see where it will take us. All I can say is we need is a few more $300 million bills in this committee, and then we'll be able to get there from here.
I understand.
Any other questions? If not, Senator Solon, do you want to make your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd move that Senate File 281 as amended be recommended to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill? Is that how you'd like to do it?
You've heard the motion. Those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Is Senator Marty here? I guess he'll be here a little bit later. So we'll take Senate File 843 next.
Senate File 843 deals with COLA rate increase for community-based providers. There's a fiscal note and some amendments in your materials. Senator Berglund.
Chair and members of the committee, this bill also is a bill to deal with COLAs for long-term care providers. My hope that we would be giving some kind of a COLA to all the long-term care providers, not just one group. And we had left the percent blank because we were not sure what the budget would allow us to do on COLA this year. But the bill does have two other features that have not been presented to us in the past. And one of those features is the fact that we have more of our providers in long-term care now that are contracted with managed care. And so there's been a concern that those providers have whatever COLA is given passed along to them also through the managed care organizations. So that language is in this bill. And then the second thing that's in the bill is providing language that would provide an increase for sleep staff who may not be getting the minimum wage in the future. So with that, I'd like to call on Bruce Nelson to come and talk a little bit about the bill. And while he comes up to the table, I guess what I can say is that we were hoping that we would at least, I realize we've got blanks in this fiscal note, so the fiscal note is zeros. But we were hoping that we would at least get some idea of whether the issue of passing on a cost of living increase in the managed care rates would have a fiscal impact or not. And based on this fiscal note, we can't really tell that. So,
Senator Berglund, before we go into testimony, is there an amendment on this bill that you wanted to offer on Senate File 843?
Yes, if somebody could bring it to me.
Okay. I believe that's the A2 amendment.
Right. This is an amendment that my staff and I worked on. It's another alternative way of trying to put an encumbrance into the COLA. I think the main difference between this one and the one we just adopted is that this one would divide the COLA into a certain amount that would go for wages and a certain amount that would go for the other parts of the compensation package, including the health care benefits. So that we would make sure that at least some of this was going to wages. And,
so, Senator Burgum.
It has blanks in it also, since we don't exactly know what the COLA would be yet.
Senator Berglund moves adoption of the A2 amendment.
Yes.
Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted. And now Senator Berglund will proceed with testimony. I'm sorry I didn't catch your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is, and members of the committee or the division, my name is Bruce Nelson. I'm with ARM. ARM is an association of providers who support people with disabilities in ICFCMR, the MRRC or DD waiver, TBI waiver, CADI waiver, and CAC waiver, and a smattering of other services as well. Oh, thank you. First off, I want to say voice ARM's gratitude over the last really 10 years and sometimes through some very tough times. And finding the resources to provide at least some measure of increase in COLAs that I'm very proud to say that ARM members do pass on to a significant extent, about 76% last time, to direct support professionals. We police it very hard, and I'm very proud of how our members do that. I just was reviewing the language, Senator Berglund, in your bill, and we may even have a simpler approach that could get to assuring that everybody does, in fact, get something, and we support that concept very much. I wanted to give a little perspective on where the money goes, and especially in the last couple years. In the last 2 years, COLAs were 2.26% in each of those 2 years. And I looked at, and it's kind of hard to figure, but pegged pretty much around $10.77 is an average wage that direct support professionals make. There are about 27,000 of them among our membership. These are the people who provide the day in and day out supports to people with disabilities. That applying 2.26% would mean about 24 cents an hour, which is less than $500 a year. So I took that and looked at, we're all, you know, filling our cars with gas at the pump and watching the price of gas go up and down, but by and large up, and kind of figured, well, what if somebody drove 100 miles a week and there was over the course of a year a 10-cent gas hike, which is probably low. That would amount to over $500. So that COLA amount of 2.26% is gone. In fact, you know, even though COLAs were provided and in very tough times, the amount of COLA in terms of purchasing power to inflation, folks have gone backwards. Over the last 4 years, the average rate and compensation increase was 3.53%, that included a year with a cut, and over that same period, inflation, the cost of living, was 12.77%. I wanted to also give you a little perspective on how this money works, and I thought that maybe the best way would be to compare it to state employees who do the same work in state-operated facilities. In the governor's budget, he provided for, I believe it's 3.5% for state or
3.25%.
3.25%. My point will still hold. 3.25% for direct support people in state-operated facilities. Now, keep in mind, should that number come to fruition, that's for wages. Health insurance is separate. So that's 3.25% in the governor's budget. And we also, you know, are really glad to see it's only been twice in the last 10 years when the governor's put in anything. But I want to compare that to what is also in the governor's budget, 2% COLA for the providers in Senator Berglund's bill. That 2% covers wages, and it also covers health insurance. And on top of that, all of the operations, the training, the administrative costs, the heating, the transportation, and so forth that go into running programs for people with disabilities. So, and I'm not sure folks all realize that when you're adopting a COLA.
Madam Chair, the 3.25% that's in the governor's budget is for wages, health care, and pensions. And then if the facility has increased costs due to heating and food or anything like that, they're going to have to absorb those costs in the governor's budget. And I think that's the only exception is the Veterans Homes Board, where there was inflation given for their heat and other operating costs in the governor's budget.
Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Senator Berglund.
I'm not trying to make it sound like, you know, these folks don't deserve a larger COLA, but I do think we need to make sure we understand that the COLA that's in the governor's budget for the state-operated services is 3.25%, and it's for everything.
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, I stand corrected. I will say this, however, historically, when the state negotiates contracts with employees, health insurance has historically been separate from wages and been a higher figure. But I do stand corrected. Thank you, Senator Berglund. We've gone over in several bills here the provisions in the bill, and I'll answer questions if I can. But I wanted to say just two other things, that the ultimate impact of whatever you're able to provide in a COLA is for the direct support professionals, and they are ultimately the people and the way that we provide health, safety, and quality of life to where we really want to ultimately get it, and that is for people with disabilities. They're the heart of the operation. That's where the money goes primarily, and whatever you can muster out of your target. And there are lots of other needs that you're going to be wrestling with. The impact will, in the end, be in health, safety, and quality of life for people with disabilities, our most vulnerable citizens. With that, I thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Nelson. I think that I can speak for members of the committee and say that we appreciate your recognition that we are squeezing and wrestling with the budget that we are faced with. Are there questions from members? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, when you gave the figure for the amount of wages paid, it was $10.60 or something for the average wage, I think you said?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Nelson.
Senator Olson, the average was, based on research a year ago, $10.77. Now, the starting figure is much lower than that, and it's also compounded by an average turnover of 45%.
Senator Madam Olson. Chair, and is that figure paid evenly around the state, or are there geographic differences in terms of the amount paid?
There are, in fact, Mr. geographic Nelson. Differences, and I have brought that research with me. I think I left it in my folder. I'll share it with you. And it does break down around the state, and it is, in fact, much lower in the rural parts of Minnesota. And I could share that with you. I have it right in my briefcase unless you want me to do it in front of the committee.
Senator Madam Chair, Olson. Well, I'm just trying to get a feel, without having those exact numbers available, whether based on your information, the areas that are struggling the most, are we struggling evenly in terms of providing these services around the state, or are we having more difficulties in the rural areas providing the same services because of the lower wage scale?
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, it's hard to break down rural and urban. I would say there probably are pockets where it is more difficult, and that is because the money in waivered services goes from the state to the county. And then the contracts are negotiated with the provider and the county. some counties have less in their budgets relative to need, and because of that, the problem is more acute. But it's hard to make a general statement that it's more difficult in one general area of the state than others.
And, Madam Chair, I might just add that's another area where we've had problems with the COLA, and that is getting the counties to pass on the COLA based on the same time frame that the legislature makes it available. And so the counties kind of hold back on the COLA and say, well, we'll give them the COLA the next time we negotiate their contract. Well, then there's people that aren't getting the COLA in the waivered services at the same time that other facilities are giving COLAs to their workers. And in fact, we believe that the counties may have some money that they actually have as a float that is not gone out to anybody in terms of a COLA. And so we're looking into that.
Okay. Senator Berglund, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I would move then that Senate File 843 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
And Senator Berglund's motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Senate File 843 has been adopted and laid over for possible inclusion. Mm-hmm. We will move on.
I don't see Senator Marty here yet, so I don't. We will take Senate File 612 next.
Senate File 612, ICFMR Pleasant. Senator Berglund.
And if I could just ask if there is a fiscal note on this bill, if someone could bring it to me.
Should be in the packet.
Not complete.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, this bill deals with an ICFMR facility in my district that is requesting that they be able to convert their facility. They are serving people in this facility since the 1970s, and their population has become aged. And they have the facility that they operate today is a 15-bed facility. They would like to convert the facility to 2 6-bed Class B facilities, and that would allow them to have handicapped accessible facilities and would be able to provide additional staffing to serve the more aged population of people with disabilities. Hennepin County supports this proposal. There is a letter that has been provided by the county because they believe that their county needs additional capacity of facilities to serve elderly people with disabilities. Currently, there is no mechanism for a rate adjustment for any reason through the Department of Human Services. And so they are here requesting a legislative remedy. The bill provides for a rate payment of $247. This is below the statewide average of $243.69 for Class B facilities. And with that, I'd like to ask you to take testimony from Nina Hayes.
Senator Berglund, before we begin with testimony, do you have an amendment that you'd like to offer?
I don't know.
I'm looking at Senator Berglund. I'm suggesting that perhaps there's an amendment that you'd like to offer.
Maybe somebody could bring here I've
the
got
A1
it.
Amendment.
Yeah, I've got it.
Senator Berglund.
No, I don't have it.
It's on its way. This means that I'm starting to think like Senator Berglund.
Is that good or bad?
I'm not sure. Senator Berglund.
Okay. The A1 amendment is pretty much a technical amendment. Madam Chair, I move adoption of the amendment.
Senator Berglund moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. And with that, we will proceed with testimony.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I just want to ask a clarification question, Senator Berglund, because some of the data is overwhelming. You referred to this rate, $200.47, as below the typical rate by something around $43 for Class B facilities. Could you clarify the Class B facility issue, what that relates to?
Senator Berglund.
I think Nina will do that when she gives her testimony.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And with that, we'll begin our testimony. Nita Hayes, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for hearing my testimony and bill. Our request is for a conversion from a Class A to a Class B services. Class A services are typically for less needy individuals without ambulation or fire egress requirements, where the person's able to evacuate independently. Class B requires the facility to serve individuals who aren't able to evacuate for fire. There's more building codes, and typically it's a medically or behaviorally coded service. And so that's the difference between the A to the B conversion. Also, accessibility is the main reason for this request. Most of our individuals have been served in the system for 20 to 30 years. Consider that when they are having ambulation issues, they're required to go into nursing facilities or more restrictive care, which costs the taxpayer more. And so the main intent is to prevent people from going into higher medical services and to keep them sustained in an ICFMR level of service, which can be successfully done by getting a building that is accessible, newer, and the property that we're in is a very old building, and there's no way to do an elevator or ramps, stairs, chairs, et cetera. And so we're basically locked in, you know, with having to relocate. We went to the county, and we've worked with them for about a year to look at waivered service options, and the funding isn't adequate to meet this population's needs because of the caps and the averages and so forth. We just can't touch the needs that they have. And so their recommendation was to go from an A to B conversion and relocate and split into two smaller sites, which we are excited to do and have that opportunity to keep people together who've lived together for many, many years. And so they're operating similar to a family unit. I think that the most important piece to this is that in the long run it will cost less, because if they went into a higher level needs service, that the dollars will add up faster, and this will keep them, and hopefully we would be able to serve them through the rest of their life in a community-based service.
Ms. Hayes, thank you for your testimony. Senator Berglund.
If there are no questions, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 612 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. And with that, we will take up Senate File 679, Senator Marty.
I think Senator Marty is here, so I think we'll take his bill next so he can get back to whatever else he needs to do.
Senator Marty, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 679 is another one of the COLA bills, and this one is backed by a coalition of seniors and employees, workers of the nursing homes. And I point that out because I think it's an interesting and important connection there, and I think it's that people that a lot of the seniors, people who are most common consumers of the long-term care, are people who realize that the fair treatment of the employees is a very critical part of quality care. And the bill, basically, I have a letter from AARP in support of the bill that I'd like to have distributed if it can be. And the bill basically provides an annual COLA of 5%, of which 3/4 of the money would be dedicated to salary and benefits for workers, and then provides another 1% additional increase per year to enhance the staffing of nursing home. And that's very important given the fact that we've had so many of our nursing homes are short on short on employees, which tends to lead to mistakes in care. It tends to lead to back injuries from trying to move people understaffed. And it means there's a lot heavier turnover of the workers. And I have talked to some nursing home residents who have pointed out the fact that when you have a number of different people coming in because of the heavy turnover, that it causes great loss of dignity when you have more people dealing with very personal functions, that it's not a plus. It's a loss of dignity for the nursing home resident. And so this bill is an attempt to try and make sure that we provide both much-needed funding and that it be dedicated in a large part to wages and benefits for the employees and to more staffing. Can go through the bill. I have two witnesses to testify in support of the bill, and maybe like to start with Jane Okamoritz from Alzheimer's Association.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Good morning, Madam Chair. Can you hear me all right? Okay. And committee members. My name is Jane Okramovic, and I'm pleased to represent the Alzheimer's Association in support of the Seniors and Workers for Quality 2007 Legislative Initiative, Senate File 679, that's authored by Senator Marty. Our coalition is built on a connection between quality care and quality long-term care jobs. Our bill reflects many facets of that relationship. Today, the common theme in the bills before you is a cost of living adjustment, or COLA, for long-term care workers. However, our bill covers all the bases, residential facilities, home, and community care. The 5% COLA that we propose for all facilities will make a difference, particularly with the provisions of the bill that dedicate 75% of the funds to the salary and benefits of the employees. As you'll note, there are several sections of the bill that focus specifically on nursing homes. For example, additional funding is provided for hiring new hands-on staff. Financial pressures and layoffs over the last 4 years have made working short dangerously prevalent. Short staffing yields hurried care, risk to residents, back injuries for staff, and low morale all around. Those back injuries that Senator Marty mentioned are just some of the reasons that health insurance for those low-wage workers is financially out of their reach. Our bill would open Minnesota care to them, even in circumstances where the employer offers coverage, because that coverage is usually too costly to buy. We also realize that the health care access issue is being broadly discussed before you this year. So please make sure that healthcare workers can obtain health care for themselves. We advocate for this mission. The method that it's accomplished is wholly up to you. Some of the most challenging nursing home care is needed by those with Alzheimer's and related disorders. Senate File 679 recognizes that behavioral care has not been adequately reimbursed in our acuity-based reimbursement system. A few years ago, the Department of Human Services commissioned research that verified what seniors and workers have known from experience. Let's not wait any longer to provide the resources for staffing behavioral care. Now, to a larger point, nursing home rates differ not only by resident needs, but by historical distinctions among regions of the state and individual adjustments for specific facilities and counties. We support taking a fresh look at principles of fairness through a rebasing of the rates. I complete this testimony with a look to the future, to my own long-term care and to yours. We hear a lot about the downsizing of the nursing home sector and the specialized care that will be their niche. We hear a lot about the flourishing of home and community care. We have a few hard facts where the workforce for tomorrow's care is coming from. Our bill asks that we commit funds to providing educational opportunities to prepare people for a variety of direct care careers. The health care core curriculum was developed as a result of legislation carried by Senator Berglund back in 1999. We don't have to start from scratch, but we do have to be realistic when we talk about where people will be cared for in the future and assure the availability of trained caregivers. Thank you very much for your support and attention.
Any questions?
Madam Chair, before I have the rest of the testimony, I found out the fiscal note does not incorporate, because for good reason, because we didn't have the filled in the blanks yet. But I would like it if somebody would offer an amendment on page 6, line 4. The blank percent was going to be 5% there. And on page 8, for the community services, it would be 5% on both lines 8.10 and line 13 as well. And that was not incorporated. I forgot we did not take care of that blank percentage in there. That was what was intended in the bill, and the fiscal note reminded us that it was not in there.
Madam Chair, I would so move that oral amendment for Senator Marty.
You've heard the motion. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, then, Senator Marty, the question is, now that we have the blanks filled in, what is the cost of the bill?
It's a good question. I don't know, and I...
We just found out that a 7 and 6 is around $300 million. This is a 5 and a 5, so maybe like $250?
Yeah, it's probably around that range. I will find. I'm sorry, I don't know right now. And I also wanted to point out a couple other things in the bill that I did not do earlier. First of all, it has some workforce training provisions in the bill. Witness just mentioned, it also has a thing that's very similar or identical to what you have in Senate File 2 in terms of making workers eligible for Minnesota care. And there was one other provision I was going to mention, but I'll think of that in a minute. And I'll turn over to Steve Hunt.
Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Hunt, and I work in the long-term care sector. Excuse me. The long-term care sector of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU Local 113. But I'm here today because before coming to SEIU, I worked for more than 20 years as a direct caregiver in long-term care, and I'm here to speak in support of Senate File 679. While I was preparing for this morning, I was thinking about the thoughts that I could share with you to encourage you to move favorably on Senate File 679. When I started as a nursing assistant more than 20 years ago, I found myself working with people who were very compassionate and caring about the work they did. Most had a deep personal connection to caring for the elderly. Today, more than 20 years later, I still work with people who care about what they do. The problem is, there's not as many. Everyone in the industry and everyone who works hard every day will tell you that staffing is a constant strain and very challenging. Precious resources are wasted every day in marketing, recruiting, hiring, and training new staff. Staff turnover is very high, and in a moment I can tell you why. Getting new people to work in long-term care is difficult. Getting them to stay is much harder. Turnover today is even more of a problem than hiring. And the reason for this is not bad management. The problem is that we do not provide a wage, benefit, and compensation package that is competitive in today's economy. But that's not the entire reason. We often tell caregivers how important they are, that we admire the work they do, that they're indispensable, and that they are truly appreciated when they come to work every day. But this is what they face in the real world: short staffing, hard work, high rates of injuries, mandatory overtime, a constantly growing consumer base of subacute care, dementia, Alzheimer's, mental health and behavioral care, locked and unlocked units, long-term and short-term stays, and crisis management are all part of the reality that they face every day. In addition to that, do you know what they see? They see not enough time to provide the care with dignity, the care that they really want to provide. They find out that they don't have the time to help people to the bathroom when they need to go, time to help them eat properly, time to brush their teeth or comb their hair. Workers today certainly appreciate the admiration for the work they do, but they see the challenges every day in how they do their job, and they carry this frustration home at the end of every shift. I believe that Senate File 679 is fiscally responsible. By facing the challenges of wages, hiring, retention, and staffing, we not only address the challenges that caregivers face, but it could also allow the industry some money in savings, in less turnover, and being able to attract qualified workers, resulting in better care, which results in fewer deficiencies and higher consumer confidence, which would result in better bed referrals and a higher census. Senate File 679 is a collaborative work designed to help address the challenges of compensation, hiring, staffing, training, and something even more important. It begins to address the needs of providing adequate care, care with dignity, in evolving institutional and community-based models of care. And I would like to leave you with one more thought. Senate File 679 includes a cost of living adjustment, and I know that you're going to consider different ways to do this in 679 and other proposals. The public and the workers see COLA bills as a wage increase. Making sure that at least 75% of that amount goes into the pockets of the people who do the hands-on work is one effective way to continue doing what statute already does. Thank you for the opportunity to share my thoughts with you this morning.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Marty, we're just looking at the portion of the bill that gives additional funding for adding staff. And
bless you.
It looks like the idea of just giving 1% more on the operating payment rate that is dedicated for adding staff, and then the other provision you have in the bill that would require facilities to apply to the commissioner and have the commissioner allocate the money based on facilities that have low direct staff patient ratios is somewhat in conflict with each other.
Madam Chair, my understanding was we were looking at it 1% across the board, and I can see how applying to the commissioner for it, giving preference, is in conflict. My understanding was supposed to be 1% across the board rather than an application process for it. But I will, if anybody has more information on why that was.
Madam Chair, Jim Vossen with the UFCW and with the Seniors and Workers Coalition. The intent of our bill is that we wanted a 1% amount set aside so the facilities that wanted to upgrade staffing could upgrade, and then that the verification would be made through the department that after the fact, once they've gotten the money to do that, that the money was actually applied and used specifically for upgrading that hands-on care staffing of nursing and CNAs. It wasn't our intention was not that it was supposed to be an application first. It was that if facilities wanted to upgrade, they could upgrade up to 1%, and then that the state would verify that the monies were actually spent and that the funding did go specifically for upgrading the hands-on care staffing.
So that's your helpful. Idea is that everybody would be getting this.
Everybody could if they chose to.
But they would have to use it to add staff.
It has to be used to add staff, and that's the verification that would be done by the department to verify that it was to increase specifically the hands-on care staffing. That's
okay,
the concept.
So then I think
it.
The language doesn't really work because it says apply to the commissioner.
Madam Chair, yeah, I think that paragraph C does seem to contradict that. But, yeah, my understanding was the same, that it was going to be across the board eligible. Every nursing home would be eligible for it. But you're right, this language in paragraph C contradicts that, and maybe that should be.
Well, I don't know if we're going to have money for this anyway.
I understand that.
You know, we like to have the bills in shape so that if we do, then we can just pick up the language. So maybe we can see if we can work on this a little bit.
Madam Chair, I think paragraph C is not contradicts, as you said, the intent of the bill. And maybe that could just be deleted. I don't know that would require anything else, because we do have the paragraph D does require the information on it, the pre-reporting back on that. And paragraph C is the one that, as counsel pointed out, is not contradicts the concept of 1% each.
Okay, so would you like someone to make that motion?
To delete section paragraph C.
Madam Chair, I'll make that motion.
Senator Rosen will move the motion for Senator Marty to delete that paragraph. Those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
And Madam Chair, I understand the budget difficulties. I would like to make the pitch again that the reason that the Coalition of Seniors and Workers came together was because the recognition that a major factor in quality of care comes from good compensation for workers, which, as I know you know, and we agree on, so, but I wanted to make that case.
Senator Marty, in regard to the portion of the bill about employees being able to apply for Minnesota Care, that portion of the bill has a $13 million fiscal note on it. And and I guess the limitation here is that people would have to be eligible income-wise to be able to come into the Minnesota Care program. And I mean, all we're doing is removing the employer-subsidized insurance barrier, as I understand it.
Right. So it was not meant to change who was eligible for it other than that one barrier, that if the employer has it available and the worker can't afford it, that would not block them from Minnesota Care because of that.
And then another idea that has been floating around in the past is to provide a mechanism through the rates for people to buy into Minnesota Care for all their employees. And that would draw down federal dollars to help subsidize that cost. And
Madam Chair, anything we can do to draw down federal dollars, the goal is to get the workers, these are people who are providing health care who can't get it, and I think any way we can get more federal dollars to accomplish that is a wise way to go. In other words, this is the concept here was more we'd like to try and help push it, and I know Senate File 2 has some of that in as well.
So
the goal is to find a way to do that.
I think if we were going to go the latter route, it would require a little bit more study because we know that most of the facilities have something in their rate for health care already, and we wouldn't want to duplicate that funding. So I'm just asking how people feel about, you know, studying this longer or whether the preference would be to move ahead with the provision in this bill now.
Madam Chair, we're open to what we're seeking is just this has been a long-term problem. And we're just seeking to find solutions. You know, we realize that we can't expect everything's going to happen today, but we want to try and find some avenue that somehow in the future we can look to find a better vehicle or a more cost-effective vehicle so that these people can get insured. So we're open to whatever discussions are going to move forward, and we're more than willing to work with you on whatever way we can to help facilitate that change in the future.
Are there any other questions about the bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I'd like to move that Senate File 679 laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Senator Rosen has made the motion. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
right, members, we will now be taking up Senate File 261, Nursing Home Exception Proposal Criteria. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members of the division, first of all, I'd just like to start off by saying that this bill does not have a fiscal note here today, so we'll be getting the fiscal note later. The next thing that I'd like to say is that ever since we've had the nursing home moratorium, we have seen a need to have a process by which we reinvest in our facilities, where we either are allowing facilities to remodel or we're allowing older facilities that need to be destroyed and rebuilt to be rebuilt. You can't have a nursing home moratorium for very long without having a mechanism to do that, because then all you have is facilities that are continuing to age. This bill is a bill that would provide funding for the nursing facility moratorium exception process for this biennium. Just because we have a few new members on the committee, I guess two of them at least here at the moment, or three maybe, if we're all listening. The nursing home moratorium process is one where we set aside money, but then the nursing homes go through a competitive process to get that money for their facilities. And there is a review board that looks at their proposals and judges them based on the needs of the existing facility, the needs of the area, and the needs of state as a whole. This bill authorizes money for a new round of moratorium exception projects. It asks the Department of Health, when evaluating the proposals, to look at the continuing need for nursing facilities in that community. In other words, we don't want to rebuild an old facility in a community where the nursing homes are closing beds and we've invested in a facility then that's not going to remain open. So that's new language that's added here. The bill also allows for technical changes to the moratorium process to provide for calculations, including an increase in the replacement cost limits and the equipment allowance to allow more projects to adequately fund the new consumer expectations of technology in new facilities. The current law also doesn't allow for reimbursement for capital expenditures unless the total for the project reaches a minimum threshold of over $200,000. This means that there is no recognition in the rates for investments in items required by the law, such as separate rooms for oxygen storage or sprinkling all or part of the facilities. So this section would allow for smaller projects that would improve safety and quality using depreciation guidelines to set the state payment rates. And then just to remind the members, 54% of the nursing homes in the state will need to be replaced or renovated in the next 10 years to keep up with today's standards. So I would maintain that it is an important part of our budget, along with providing COLAs for workers. We do need to reinvest in our physical plants as well. And we don't have a fiscal note here, but I would like to take the testimony on the bill today since we have time. It's here to testify on the bill.
Patty Cullen, Care Providers of Minnesota. Ms. Cullen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Patty Cullen, Vice President of Care Providers of Minnesota, speaking on behalf of the long-term care imperative. Senator Berglund did a good job in summarizing the different components of this bill. I'm only here before you to talk about why it is needed and kind of the good bang for the buck you get with the investment in the moratorium dollars. The moratorium process, as Senator Berglund noted, has been underway for since mid-1980s. It's a competitive process. There is a panel that reviews each of the projects looking at specific criteria that have been established in statute, things such as what's the bed usage around the community, is the project valuable in terms of meeting the private room needs, improving quality of life for the residents there, those kind of things. So we are supportive of the process that is used to make sure that the investment of dollars goes to the facilities that present their best case to this committee. And the competitive process is not being changed under this. All we're suggesting is that we need to continue to fund it so there's some money for them to spend. As I mentioned in the policy committee, the investment in state dollars is a good investment because for each $1 million of state dollars for the moratorium exception process, you actually can get $75 million worth of construction projects. That's the last round it translated into that kind of investment, which is significant in terms of the economic development. When you look at buildings and construction and everything else, I think you need to look a little bit beyond the benefit to the residents, its benefits to the communities as well. And we do know that every project last time that went through the moratorium exception process was not able to be funded. And we do know that there are facilities that, especially with the revisions here and in the investment per bed limits and the allowance for equipment, would be interested. When folks wonder about the financial crisis that facilities had, why they're also looking at construction, it's two different perspectives. There's a lot of fundraising that goes on in order to come up with the money to start out with the moratorium exception process and do the capital improvement and investments. If we don't look at the next 20 years down the road on what the expectations are, for folks that have toured facilities in their districts, you can certainly tell the difference between one of the facilities that has been renovated or built in the last 10 years and one of the facilities that were built in 1960s, which is the vast majority of the facilities, especially in rural communities. I'd be happy to take any questions. Otherwise, we urge you to support this proposal.
Madam Chair, the other thing I just like to say is that there's never, and I underline that, never been a time in the history of the state of Minnesota since the moratorium has been imposed where a governor has included money in his budget for a moratorium exception process. And so that means then, you know, because of that irresponsibility of the governor's budget proposal, we have to go in and either take other items out of the governor's budget or cut some existing programs to find money for a moratorium process exception. And let me tell you, if we don't find that money, we will then have facilities coming in one by one with their senators asking for us to fund them one by one. Believe me, you don't want to do that. You don't want to be there. You don't want to go there.
Duly noted, Senator Berglund. Are there questions from members of the committee? Senator Berglund.
And even though we don't have a fiscal note on this bill, Madam Chair, you know, it's just like all the other bills. We'll have to see if we can fit something into the budget. And so with that, I would move that Senate File 261 be laid over for possible inclusion in this bill.
Senator Berglund's motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you very much.
And with that, the meeting will adjourn.
That's it?
Mm-hmm. We already heard
press for fingers. They finished their fiscal.
That is?
We have a short committee tomorrow, members, because the floor session has been called up for 10, I believe.
She talked about the 3.25.
Is there a floor session today?
And then if yes. You did a similar 11:44 other.
Hang with us.